Okay, good evening. Here we are up to one of the more well-known or noteworthy passages in the Rambam's Hakdama LaPerek Chelek. Again, just by way of review, the Rambam starts this discussion on the Mishnah in Masechet Sanhedrin, which says, Kol Yisrael yesh lam chelek olam haba. All Jews have a share in the world to come. Chutz me, except for a list of people who lose their share in the world to come. So the Rambam feels it's necessary to kind of make a diversion from his commentary on the Mishnah to speak about these weighty matters. Olam haba, who's in, who's out, what are the criteria? He started off the discussion, as you recall, with a diagnosis, as it were, a kind of outline of mistaken notions of what Olam Haba is really like. Since he was talking about Olam Haba, he then gets on to the second major topic, which is the notion that the whole discussion about Olam Haba is, as I described it previously, spiritually distracting, because we get very focused on the rewards and what we're going to be getting, and it takes our attention away from what we really ought to be doing down here, which will garner us ultimate reward, surely. But that's not the purpose of doing the mitzvot. That's not the purpose of doing the mitzvot. That brings him to that larger discussion of lishma, of doing mitzvot lishma, what we sometimes refer to colloquially as Torah lishma, specifically in regard to Torah study, but more generally speaking regarding all of avodat Hashem, all of mitzvah observance, all of the entirety of the religious life. That's what we've discussed up until now. Now here in the third section. In the third section, at least in the Shilat edition that we're looking at, he addresses another major topic. And you'll see as we move along, all of these individual topics fit together like pieces of a puzzle, leading up to the main discussion of what are the principles of faith which one need subscribe to, lest he loses his share in the world to come. Since the Rambam is saying, since everything that we know about Olam Haba and Tchiyat HaMetim, resurrection, ultimate reward, etc., 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 everything that we know about it is culled from the realm of rabbinic literature and wisdom called the Agadah. What we sometimes call midrash. I'll define these terms a little more carefully as we move along. We need to have a clear idea of what that genre is and how it's properly interpreted. And the proper interpretation of what Chazal were trying to tell us through the Agadic literature, through the midrashic literature, is essential if we're going to then turn to those sources as the fountain from which we draw all of our beliefs about these weighty, weighty matters. In other words, as opposed to the purely halachic categories, and again, for convenience sake, we divide rabbinic literature between halacha and agada. Although the precise dividing lines are a little vague. Halacha, for example, well, we know what halacha looks like, feels like, smells like. Some of us are learning Masechet Sukkah here on the Web Yeshiva. So Masechet Sukkah deals with things like lulav hagazol ve'yavish pasul. If you take a stolen lulav, if you steal a lulav and you try to shake a lulav, it's pasul, it's invalid, and you can't do that. And the Gemara will detail exactly what's stolen, and when is it stolen, and how is it stolen, and why is it pasul, and what about the first day, and what about the subsequent days, and what's the source for this. This is halacha. Halacha also Sometimes we talk about halakha with a capital H, and sometimes we talk about halakha with a lowercase h. Garden variety halakha, lowercase h halakha, that's what we also sometimes synonymously call dinim, laws, something that you would look up in the Mishnah Brura or the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. You have a question, you want to know, what bracha do you make on water? Well, that's a halakha. And sometimes halakha, we talk about writ large in the capital H, as it were. And there, sometimes halakha is used to kind of encapsulate the entirety of the system, the entirety of all of Judaism. So, for example, when Rabbi Soloveitchik talks about the ish halakha, the halachic man, he's talking about, with a capital H, he's talking about halakha with, meant to be synonymous with the whole system. What some other writers might use the term Judaism, or even sometimes we'll talk about the Torah. Like sometimes you'll go to shul and you'll hear the rabbi talking about the Torah says, and you're looking frantically through your Chumash or through your Tanakh and you can't find it. It's not written. There's no verse in the Bible that says what the rabbi says that the Torah says. Because he's not saying the Torah, meaning the Chumash. He's using the term Torah as a larger concept, synonymous with what somebody else might have said, the Jewish view is, ... Halakha, again, for our purposes, means, as opposed to Agadah, means the halachic system, the manner in which Chazal formulated the Torah Shebaal Peh, the laws that emanate from the Chumash and the explanations that went along with them to Moshe and Sinai, and the manner in which Chazal extrapolated from that other halachot, the manner in which Chazal made their own takanot and gzerot, their own laws and institutions to protect it. That's halacha. Agadah, on the other hand, is the whole corpus of wisdom, of ethics, of teachings, of everything from the personal habits and conduct of the chachamim, the purported personal habits and conduct as recorded by Chazal of the Avot and the biblical figures, the filling in the blanks, the reading between the lines of the biblical stories, which are of course not written in the Tanakh, but are communicated to us through the Agadah, whether they're meant to be historically true. Sometimes no doubt they are meant to be historical record, but more likely they're meant to encapsulate some type of larger message. All of this, everything from the meaning of, the deeper meaning of the meta halacha to garden variety folklore and everything in between, that's generally what we refer to as the Agadah. Sometimes we also use the term Midrash. But that can be a little misleading, because Midrash has also two sides of a coin. Midrash sometimes means, this genre of rabbinic literature that I just described, synonymous with Agadah. But Midrash also has in it what we call Midrash Halakha. And that is the manner, the drashot, the mechanics by which Chazal interpret the Tanakh for halachic purposes. So Midrash Halakha really looks more like the first category of what we call Halakha, and Midrash Agadah is more like the second. Sometimes we're not careful with the terms and we use Midrash to be synonymous with Agadah, but that's not always the case, and you have to be careful with your terms. Our friend and colleague and teacher, Rabbi Yitzchak Blau, who some of you no doubt must study with here with us on the Web Yeshiva, he just published this wonderful book called fresh fruit and vintage wine, which is an analysis of very many agadot from the Gemara, trying to give a very close, deep reading of certain agadot, some famous, some that might be unknown to you. And so since we're talking about Agadah, I mentioned that book. If somebody's got a free hand, they can Google it and put up a link. It was published by Ktav. Let's see if I can't do that for you. That's definitely worth taking a look at. Oh, here you go, right there. Fresh Fruit and Vintage Wine, Ethics and Wisdom of the Agadah. Here it's coming up in the chat box. There you go. So the Rambam, again, he seems to be in this kind of mode where he's doing this classification. Just like he spelled out the five mistaken views on Olam Haba, he tells us here regarding the Divrei Chachamim, Mimashit Sarech Ataladat ki Divrei Chachamim Aleihem Hashalom Nechlaku Bahem Bnei Adam L'Shalosh Kitot. There are three categories of people. There are three approaches to understanding rabbinic literature, to understanding what Chazal were trying to do. Two mistaken ones and one correct one, as opposed to his treatment of Olam Haba. He gave you the five mistaken views, and he has yet to tell us what the correct view is. Here he spells out the three views. One is mistaken for one reason, one is mistaken for a different reason, the third reason is the proper mode of interpretation. So let's see if we can't make some headway on this this evening. Hakata Rishona, the first category of a mode of interpreting the Divrei Chazal is this. V'hi rov shira'itiv mi shira'iti chiburav u'mi sheshamati alav. And this is the majority of folks. Now again, he's describing within the religious community, within people that, you know, you might be sitting next to in shul, people who get up every morning in Davin, put on tefillin, keep kosher, keep Shabbos, nice, good, frum yidden. But they're mistaken in how to interpret Chazal. They're mistaken in how to interpret Chazal, and that mistake may actually undermine their observance. It certainly deflates the sublime nature of any observance, but it might ultimately lead them away from the proper behavior. And he says this first category, it's most of the folks out there, tikabel otam kifshatam. Most people will interpret rabbinic teachings according to the pshat, according to the simple surface meaning. Velo tifashem perush nistar bishum panim. And they won't interpret according to a concealed meaning. Pshat, I assume, is a term that's familiar to you in terms of the four levels of biblical interpretation. Pshat, remez, drash, sod makes up that acronym pardes, the orchard. Here we're not talking about biblical interpretation, we're talking about the manner in which to read what Chazal are saying. But there's the pshat, there's the black on white, the literal meaning, and then there's the interpreted meaning. And the Rambam says most people read the pshat, most people read the simple surface meaning, and that's what they think it is. V'yu etzla hanimnaot kulan mechuyavot hamitziut. And if you read the literal interpretation, that will force you to believe certain impossibilities as being necessarily true. We'll give some examples as we move on. But this is connected to a larger point about language. And this is why I asked you This is why I asked you to take a look at the Rambam's introduction to the Guide to the Perplexed. He has a number of different introductory passages before he starts section 1, chapter 1. But this is the part that in English is called the object of the guide, where he tells you what it is that he's setting out to do. Maybe you can each chat into me, you can chat to me privately, whether or not you've had a chance to read this carefully. Can you please do that so I have a sense of whether or not you've done this? In the chat box, you can send to host or presenter, either way on both of them, and chat to me, yes or no, whether or not you've made a careful read of this. Okay. I'm appreciating the honesty. Okay, so we'll come back to this. People who haven't responded, I'm going to take that as a no. If I'm mistaken, please let me know. So the Rambam says, Amnam yasukein l'sichlutam v'chochmot v'richukam min hamada'im v'ein behem min hashleimut kidei shit'oruru me'atzman. Again, shleimut, perfection. Perfection for the Rambam. Perfection for the Rambam means a type of. It means the intersection of a number of different things, but primarily a refinement of intellect. So somebody that will read an Agadah of Chazal, a story about, I don't know, let's say the sun and the moon having an argument. You're probably familiar with this Agadah from Rashi at the beginning of Parshat Bereshit, about the sun and the moon having an argument. Now, whatever that Agadah is talking about, it doesn't mean that the sun and the moon literally had an argument, and that the moon was very arrogant, and because of that, the it's reduced, where once the sun and the moon were of identical weight. And if you believe that literally, instead of trying to understand the point that Agadah is trying to encapsulate, so it's an indication that you're not of a particularly refined intellect. And if you are not of a particularly refined intellect, there's no way that on your own you're going to be able to come to the true interpretation of what Chazal are trying to say. And you're going to then be led to believe, Lefichach, Heim Sovrim, these people think, Shelo kivnu achachamim b'chol mamareihem hamechukamim, ela ma shehevinu heim mehem. So it's not just that you don't properly understand what Chazal were talking about, but you begin to think that if you read enough of anything, and you think that you're reading it properly, and it appears to be, let's say, foolish to you, that's going to lead you to a certain conclusion about A, what this literature has to teach you, and B, what the author was like. V'shehinam kifshateihem v'af al pi shepashtei katsat divreihem yesh behem min harichuk ad she'ilu supru kifshatam lahamon b'nei adam v'chol shechen liyichideihem hayu mishdomamim al hama'eh. In other words, you get caught, you paint yourself into an intellectual corner where you start reading, and you're reading it with a certain mode of thinking about it, where you're taking everything literally at face value. And even though at a certain point, you yourself are probably going to, this type of person himself is likely to realize that, it can't be, but you you've again painted yourself into an intellectual corner. And you'll say, Eich ye ba'olam adam shidameze v'yachshevehu l'dei amitit. How could it be that there's somebody that's really going to read these things and think that they're literally true? Kol shekein shiitav beina. V'zot hakata aniya. This group is the most impoverished, intellectually impoverished, spiritually impoverished. Yesh l'konein aleihem l'sichluta. We have to bewail, bemoan their sichlut, their intellectual infantility, their idiocy. Mipnei shehi miromemet et hachachamim l'fi machshavta. V'hi mashpila utam b'tachlit hashiflut. Because it's not just, what's the problem? It's not just that there's this whole group of people, the majority, according to the Rambam, that get it wrong. It's that it does damage to Chazal. It makes Chazal look stupid. If I read Chazal and I misinterpret it and I think that what they're saying is stupid, then I am projecting into the world this dangerous notion, this false notion, that Chazal, that the Chachamim, that our sages were stupid. V'hi eina magisha, and I would be unaware of the damage that I'm doing. Chai Hashem. That's the Rambam's way of saying oy gevalt. If the Rambam had been an Ashkenazi, he would have said oy gevalt. Ki zot hakat ma'abedet hadrat hadat u'ma'afila zohara. This group causes damage. They destroy the beauty of the religion and they darken its splendor. V'sama dat Hashem behefecha michuvan ba. And they turn everything on its head. They turn the Torah upside down, as it were. And they end up doing damage to themselves, to Chazal, to the Torah itself. Who's at fault for this? So the Rambam points the finger. He says, "Verov mishi yaseze heim adarshanim hamivarim livnei adam et asher lo yivinehu heim." He says there are darshanim, there are preachers and teachers who are responsible, because in the manner in which they interpret the Torah is such. First of all, you have preachers and teachers who themselves don't know how to properly read the Torah, to interpret the Torah, to interpret Chazal, and they are leading people down this dark path. V'halavai hayu shotkim. It would be better. It would be better that they would stay silent. Or, if they can't stay silent, it would be better for them to say, Lo neda maratzu achachamim be'elu hadvarim. Right? It would be better for them to say, Chazal say X, Y, Z. And it seems strange to us. And I don't know what it means. It's okay to say that. It's okay to say, I don't know what it means, rather than to give some forced explanation about which you're not certain, because if you do that, that leads people to subscribing to this first category. Ella yachshavu shiyevinum v'yagishu lahavin livnei adam ma shevinuhu heim benafshotam. But they think that they understand, and they go off and they teach people these mistakes. Lo ma shamru chachamim v'yidrushu b'roshei ha'am drashot b'rachot perek chelek. And they do damage to the Torah. He gives some examples of particularly problematic passages in Chazal, including our own Perek Chelek, which talks about the world to come. So if you don't know what you're talking about, you have to be really careful. And you can't dare to teach this material unless you know what it is that you're talking about. So Jay mentions that it's dangerous for the Rambam to warn us about these types of people without telling you how to spot them. it leads us to distrust teachers. Well, that may be. Although he's going to go on a little bit to paint a clear picture of, you know, it's one of those things. Who was that Supreme Court justice? Potter Stewart, Justice Stewart, you know, who said about Lahavdil Elif Alfei Havdalot, who said about pornography, I can't give you the definition, but I know it when I see it. The same thing here. If you have any experience, in authentic Torah learning, you know it when you see it. Even if you've been exposed to different styles of learning and teaching, and there are many different styles of learning and teaching which you know, which really vary very greatly. Unfortunately, there are some people in the Torah market who think it's necessary to disparage people that learn and study and teach or serve Hashem in different ways, when really it's good that there should be, you know, different types of styles, all legitimate, which doesn't mean to say that there are different legitimate styles and different modes of worshiping Hashem doesn't mean anything goes. It doesn't mean that everything is okay. It just might mean that there's more than one way, while still reserving to ourselves the possibility of saying there are certain mistaken paths. But if you've been out there in the world and you've studied Torah with great teachers, you know it when you see it. An intelligent person will come to understand what, you know, authentic Talmud Torah is. And for the Rambam, that's necessary. Now, try to connect the dots here. What was the Rambam talking about in the previous section, the section that dealt with Torah Lishma? He used a very felicitous metaphor there, a well-known metaphor of his, and they're connected. Every section of this work connects one into the next. Can anybody think about it? The Rambam there, remember the Rambam's discussion about the child going off to school and needing to be motivated with the candies, with the raisins and nuts, and then having to be motivated that he's going to get a pair of Air Jordans, and then he's going to get money, and then he's going to get... How does that connect to this? Jay, why don't you have a microphone? Jay, why don't you speak a little bit? Yeah.
Just like whether, the nuts and the candies and things like that are a simple way of getting disinterested from the religious forward to next level, the same way that, some of these stories about thought and things like that are something that appeals at an initial level, and then you can explain the deeper meaning later on, like the relationship to that.
Right, but in other words, again, the Rambam had warned us. Let me just mute you so we don't get the echo. The Rambam had warned us that any one stage is fine as long as it's developmentally appropriate at that moment. And there's always the danger of a type of retardation where you get stuck and don't move on, or the teacher doesn't bring you to the next level. So let's say, for example, when a kid studies math, in the early grades, that when you're doing simple functions, like learning addition and subtraction, so you're taught that, you know, 1 plus 1 is 2, and 2 plus 3 is 5, and 5 plus 4 is 9. And then subtraction, you're taught, is the opposite of that. 9 minus 5 equals 4. And you can check that by working it backwards. 4 plus 5 is 9, so 9 minus 5 is 4, and 9 minus 4 is 5. And you learn that math and that addition and subtraction are mirror images of each other, and they're functions that just move in different directions along some type of number line. But the number line always starts with 0. And we tell kids a lie. We tell them that there's no number smaller than 0. And as a matter of fact, when they're doing subtraction problems, if they try to do 5 minus 7, we might tell them, you can't do that. Why do we do this? Because they're not yet ready to understand the concept of negative numbers. That there are numbers that are smaller than zero. That the number line actually flows in both directions, infinitely in both directions. And zero is just the line of demarcation between two different types of numbers. Regular numbers and negative numbers. Whole numbers and regular numbers and negative numbers. At a certain point, we lift the veil and we tell them that there are negative numbers. Now, this doesn't seem to cause any type of crisis of faith. Kids, when they get to fourth grade or fifth grade or whatever it is that they learn about negative numbers, that you can do 5 minus 7, and the answer is negative 2, this doesn't cause any kind of crisis of faith. Nobody ever stops believing in mathematics because it contravenes what they, you know, this deeply held belief that they were told as children. And this is true in lots of different disciplines. We learn things in a simple way, and when we get older, we learn it in a more complex way, and part of making it more complex is removing these kinds of structures that we had to build in order to teach it in the simple way. Because in order to get a kid to understand the mechanics of simple addition and subtraction, we have to create this fiction that, you know, the number line... here you go, let's... Right? This fiction that the number line starts at 0 and goes to infinity. At a certain point, we can lift the veil and tell them that there are also negative numbers, just like there are positive numbers. I'm just having fun drawing on this whiteboard. But before they knew about the negative numbers, they had a certain notion of how the world is constructed. Even though that notion is false, it was a useful falsehood. It was a useful falsehood which helped them understand the mechanics of multiplication, of addition and subtraction. And then with those foundations, you're able to build on mathematical thinking until you then have to introduce the idea of, once again, of the negative numbers. So the Rambam is saying it's something like that. Chaim asks the question, is it false or is it limited? Well, it's false, not in the sense of a lie, not in the morally problematic sense of a lie, but it's false in the sense when you tell it. When you tell the child that the zero is the smallest number, when you tell the child that you can't do a problem like 5 minus 7, it's technically incorrect. I guess it's technically a falsehood, but not in the same kind of morally problematic way that other falsehoods are. But we know that it's not actually the whole story. But we do give them a limited, partial understanding because they're not ready to see the whole big picture. It's a kind of a training wheels. It's a kind of training wheels. Training wheels are also a fiction. It gives the child the illusion that they're riding a bicycle, when in fact they're not riding a bicycle. But it gives them the ability to learn the mechanics of what's necessary, so that when we remove the training wheels, they're ready to go. Reading Chazal Lahavdil is something like this. Serving Hashem is actually something like this. The Rambam's discussion in the second section, where he introduces this metaphor of the child and the candy, he's there talking not about how to read Chazal, he's there talking about how to serve Hashem. But the metaphor that he builds there can carry over to here, that at a certain level, when you read the stories of, this time of the year, we read all types of stories about Chazal, about Avram and the Kivshan Ha'esh, and etc. That's a particularly charged one, because that's the one that people sometimes think, children sometimes think, that that's actually written in the Torah itself, the story of Nimrod throwing Avraham Avinu into the fiery furnace, when in fact that's just a midrash cited by Rashi, but it's not actually in the Torah itself. So for the Rambam, it's the same thing here. You have to be trained to develop your understanding of what Chazal were doing. So this is the first group. This is the first group. The first group, they read the Chazal, and it all looks a little simple to them. Second group, Hakata Shnia, Rabim Gamkein, also very many and numerous. V'heim otam shiru'u divrei chachamim o shamum v'kiblum kipshatam. They similarly read or heard divrei Chazal and accepted them at the face value. V'chashvu shelo kivnu achachamim b'zeh zulat ma shemore alav pshat hadvarim. And they similarly think that Chazal were really only talking about, in other words, they really thought that the simple pshat, literal level of interpretation of what they were saying is what they actually meant. V'yatz'u, hold on a second. V'yatzu lizalzam. And that causes them to disparage Chazal. V'laganot ma she'ein bo gnai. And to criticize that which is beyond criticism, that which is not open to criticism. V'yaligu al divrei chachamim b'cholet. And they will perpetually mock the words of the chachamim. V'yachshavu shehem yoter chachamim mehem. And they will think that they, the reader, is smarter than Chazal. They'll read something, they'll say, sun and moon arguing, mountains jumping from here to there. Ah, it's stupid. So Chazal was stupid, kaviyachol, they will say. V'sichlam yoter zach. So they'll think that they are more sophisticated, and they are smarter than Chazal. V'sheheim aleihem ha'shalom pti'im. And they'll think that Chazal are stupid. They'll think that Chazal are idiots. Chasrei dat, without wisdom. Schalim bechlal ha'metziut. Ad shelo hisigu dvar b'shum panim. Etc., etc., etc. A long list of synonymous phrases to say that they'll think that Chazal don't know what they're talking about. Why? Because they, the reader, don't know how to read Chazal. V'rov mi shenofel b'zot ha'emuna heim ha'toanim l'chochmat ha'refu'ah v'hozim b'gzerot ha'kochavim. He makes an interesting point here where he says that this group of people, he says most of them are physicians or astrologers. Why physicians and astrologers is an interesting. He of course himself was a physician, and he himself of course was an opponent of astrology. Remember, astrology and astronomy are two completely different things, although you both have to, both of them require you to look up at the heavens. Astronomy, which for the Rambam was a serious, and certainly for the medievals, was a serious science, as it is today, to understand the mechanics of the physical world, you know, outside the sphere of what's happening on this earth, the planets, the stars, the moon, everything up in the heavens. But astrology, you know, what you can you know, read about in the newspaper to find out if you're a Pisces, you know, what's going to happen to you today. But the idea that we are controlled by the stars and the sun and the moon and the planets and their alignment and etc., that for the Rambam was a mistaken notion. So he singles out doctors and astrologers for particular contempt as people that fall into this habit. These may have been people who doctors today sometimes might also be this, although less so and less so. These were people that were considered chachamim. These are people that were considered the wise folk by you know, certain segments of the population, and you know, so that may put them in a position where they're more liable to mock things that appear to them to be foolish, when in fact they themselves are not putting in the necessary manpower to properly understand them. And now the Rambam says he's trying to differentiate between the first group and the second group. He says, "V'heim, this group, this category, yoter schalim min hakata rishona, v'yoter pteim, they're even more foolish. They're even more stupid than the first group. V'hi kat arura, and this, the first group, was a kat aniya. They were intellectually impoverished." But Rachmanis, they make a mistake. Not everybody's getting 1600s on their SATs. What can you do? What can you do? But this group is wicked. This group is accursed. Lefi shehi mitparetzet klapei anashim gdolei amala shekfar nitbarach achmatam etzel chachamim v'lu hayu margilim nafsham bechochmot עד שהיו יודעים איך ראוי שיבואו הדברים בעריות בעניינים הדומים להם אצל ההמון ואצל יחידים, והיו יודעים את החלק המעשי מן הפילוסופיה, היו מתברר להם האם החכמים חכמים הם ואם לא, והיו מובנים להם ענייני דבריהם. The Rambam, let me summarize that. You know, the Rambam was often criticized for being an elitist. And there's no doubt that the Rambam has a notion of intellectual elitism, that there are people that can do the heavy lifting, the heavy intellectual lifting required for a life of Avodas Hashem, and there are people that have a little more trouble with that. And the people that are in a better position to do the serious philosophizing and theologizing and thinking and contemplation and metacognition, they have a leg up in the game. And the Rambam says that it's, you know, the bigger you are, the harder you fall. The first group of people, what can you do, Rachmanis? Maybe through no fault of their own, it's probably a fault of their education. It's not necessarily an indicator of a flaw in their IQ, although it might also be that. But what can you do? They don't have the truth. They don't have the truth. They read what the Chazal say. They read it literally. They either accept that and go on their own way, or they think it's a little foolish and think that's what it is. The second group read Chazal, think that it's foolish, and say that means that Chazal were stupid. And this, of course, has an undermining effect on the integrity of the whole rabbinic and halachic system. The first group of people, what can you do? They're stupid. The second group of people take it a step further and think that Chazal are stupid. And, you know, this is a different problem. The first is an intellectual flaw. The second is a moral flaw. And these are the two different reactions to misunderstanding what Chazal were talking about. The third group, Chaim, I don't understand your question. Didn't we say what about the first group? No, in other words, they thought that the first group thinks that the teachings themselves, they take them at the literal word, and they're satisfied, because they themselves are very simplistic people, so they assume that it's very simplistic, but they don't take it to this next step of undermining the whole project of what Chazal were doing, the authority of Chazal, at the point where you start saying zilzul on what Chazal, who they were, and what they were doing, then that's a different level altogether. The third group, Vehi Chai Hashem, Oygevalt, Ma'atam Ma'od, this is a very, very, very small group. Ad Shelo Ye'amer Aleha Kat, Ela Kemosh Yomar Al Hashem Eshmini. He says, it's hardly even a group at all. It's hardly even fair to call this third group a group. This third group is the people that understand properly what's what. But it's very small. Now, as a side point, like, we have to question, like, is the Rambam being serious here? Like, he says, look, there are three ways of understanding Chazal. A tiny, tiny, tiny minority of people get it. And the overwhelming majority of people don't get it. I mean, he doesn't give you numbers, but you might think it's something like, 2% of people get it, and, the other 98, 45% think that Chazal should be interpreted literally, and I'm not doing the math properly. 50% think that, 50% think, 49.9% think they have to take Chazal literally, and 49.9% think that since Chazal meant what they said, Chazal is stupid, and 1% they get it straight. So does the Rambam really, really think the numbers are like this? I mean, who's he writing for if this is the case? It could be that there's a... slight exaggeration here when he paints the pictures this way, as if to, tell the reader, you're part of an elite, you're part of a special group. Maybe he doesn't literally mean, now here we're doing it onto him, right? In other words, maybe we can't read the Rambam precisely literally, the way he's saying he can't read Chazal literally. This is speculation on my part. But it's possible this is what he means. But he says this third group, they're hardly even large enough to be called a group. Vehema anashim asher hit amta etzlam gedulat hachachamim. This is the group for whom the words of Chazal, the greatness of Chazal, are true. Are they understand the depth of it? V'tuv rayonehem. An understanding of what's possible and what's impossible, that we don't believe it as being literally true. When you read something Chazal that seems far-fetched, so you have to understand that that's a a device which is meant to cause you to think about what is really going on here. The Rambam goes on, and we'll finish up this third group next time. But the question begs itself. We all went to high school. And in high school, we probably all went to different high schools. In high school, we learned how to read literature. And we learned how to interpret literature. And we learned, you know, in the ninth grade when we read Romeo and Juliet, we learned that there's something called symbolism. I mean, it's true that we all live what the Rambam and his contemporaries didn't. We live in a world that's after Freud, and we live in a world of deconstruction, and we live in a world of postmodernism and of literary theory and of all types of other things. But we learn that, like in literature, sometimes there's symbolism, and there are motifs, and there are things that repeat themselves, and there are key words that are meant to highlight notions. And we learn that when you read carefully, the mind is meant to be interpreting what you're reading, and there's more to it than what the black on white is. So, you know, for example, in Shakespeare, you know, Shakespeare in a number of places, in Hamlet, elsewhere, you have this notion of a play within a play. Sometimes as part of the action of the play, the characters in the play that we're watching will watch a play. And your ninth grade English teacher taught you that whenever Shakespeare does this, the play within the play is meant to be to encapsulate the message of what's going on in the larger play. It's meant to telegraph something to the characters that we, the audience, already know, as it were. It's a type of theatrical device. And so the reader, whenever you go along in Shakespeare and you come across something like this, you're meant to do a timeout to do this kind of analysis. Why does the Rambam think that people in his era, which again is the era before the novel, and it's the era before Shakespeare, why are they unable to do this type of work? Why are they unable to read literarily? Why are they unable or unwilling to deal with metaphor? When they read a pasuk that talks about Yad Hashem, the hand of God, why do they have a problem reconciling that with our belief that God doesn't have a hand? Because when we read that pasuk about Yad Hashem, we understand that it's talking metaphorically. It doesn't literally mean that God has a hand, that God has a finger. But it's talking metaphorically, but we talk metaphorically all the time. But so did people in the 12th century. They also spoke metaphorically. Metaphor is part of language. I mean, even in Tanakh, the Avot speak metaphorically. So why did the Rambam think that people, even if you're not a great intellectual or philosopher, why was there this problem or this perceived problem of being able to, you know, interpret anything beyond the literal? We very rarely read this way. We very rarely read things that are only meant to be the pshat. I mean, maybe the newspaper. Journalism is a type of writing journalism is a type of writing which really is only pshat. You know, just the facts. Right? And it's not meant to be left up to interpretation. But besides journalism, newspaper journalism at least, anything else that you read, particularly if you're reading any type of literature, whether it's the classics or it's some type of trashy novel, so it requires you to read literarily, on a higher level, on a lower level, to interpret metaphor, to interpret symbolism, to do all that type of heavy lifting. Why was this a problem for the Rambam's contemporaries? Why did he think that it's a problem? So this is the question that we have to turn our attention to. We'll continue with this third group next time. Okay. I'm not sure, Jay. The Tanakh is full of metaphors. The Tanakh is full. Now, it's true that the 12th century is different than the 16th century, but the Tanakh is full of metaphors, and in daily life, people use metaphors. Language is full of metaphors. Animal analogies, Chaim points out, etc., etc., etc. So, in other words, the 12th century wasn't less literate than the 6th century or the 3rd century when Chazal were writing the Agadot that are clearly meant to be read with a literary eye. So I'm not sure. So next time we'll finish this third group. And then we'll have to address this larger question of why did Chazal write in this manner to begin with? Why did Chazal write in this manner to begin with? Why didn't they just come out and tell you what they wanted you to know? Why did they leave it up to you to interpret? And that, again, if you haven't done so, read or reread this piece of the introduction to the Mora Nevuchim, which I have sent you. Sherry points out that, don't you think that it was caused by abject reverence for the text? Well, yes and no. In other words, reverence for the text requires that you do the work of understanding what the text means. Chazal certainly thought that was possible and that was necessary. That's why perhaps they encapsulate their teachings in the manner in which they do. So showing, you know, reading the texts literally is not necessarily a sign of reverence. And on the contrary, I mean, if the Rambam is correct, it leads to undermining the authority of the text. So I don't know if that's... Yeah, in other words, it might be a type of chassid shote, of a misguided reverence, of thinking that interpreting it literally... to not spoon feed people who are not willing to work or not capable of understanding. Tila, you're trying to explain why Chazal wrote in the way that they did? Yeah. Oh, so that we'll talk about next time. Okay, Laila Tov.